Sairam, dear listeners, and welcome back to our continuing series on Dharma, presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Today we present Professor's fifth talk in the current series. Over to Professor G. Venkatraman.
Loving Sairam and greetings from Prashanti Nilayam. This is my fifth talk in the current Dharma series and my fourth on chapter 1, which you may recall has the title Duryodhana's Envy. Well, envy seems to be an endless topic stretched over a vast territory. Anyway, I think I'll get rid of envy in this talk if I may say so. In this talk, I would like to discuss how the force of jealousy at the societal level has, across time, spilled over from the religious arena to the economic and political domain. Indeed, as far back as the Mahabharata period, one man's personal jealousy ended up as a bitter political dispute, which then led to a bloody war. Back in the days when people lived as small tribes, it was the religious leader who commanded influence and power. He not only claimed to speak for the gods, but also acted as a doctor, which is why he was at times called the witch doctor. In due course, power switched to religious elite like the monks, Brahmin priests, imams, etc. in the East, and to institutions controlling religion in the West, like the Catholic Church, for example. With the advent of Industrial Revolution in the early part of the 19th century, the power dynamics changed completely, with power shifting to political establishments of various hues based on political ideologies born out of radically different views on how wealth should be generated and shared. Implicitly, these political doctrines also defined their perception of the role religion should play in society. On the one hand, there was capitalism, in which the means of production, trade, and all such economic activity were controlled by private owners and agencies rather than the state, and all operated solely for profit. In such cases, it was the market forces that determined the price of goods bought and sold. Growth of wealth automatically became the dominating factor, and it thrived on vigorous competition. And once competition became the name of the game, inevitably there were winners and losers, with the winners taking all. That has led to sharp economic inequity, but then that is what growth is all about, namely to generate capital and hang on to it. So the free market advocates passionately believed. I am sure it would not have escaped your notice that when making huge profit becomes the name of the game, moral idealism is automatically kicked aside, and false dogmas like the end justifies the means, etc., very quickly take hold. Now, capitalism does not shut out religion, but says that religion has no say in government. This is the famous separation of the church and the state principle. In India, it is referred to as secularism, whereby the government says that would be fair to all religions and not interfere in their internal affairs. Now, capitalism seems to be the only economic philosophy that has outlived all the others, and which most countries have now adopted in some form or the other. Even as capitalism was taking strong root in Western Europe and particularly in America, driven in good measure by the Industrial Revolution, I am now talking of the 19th century, many European thinkers of that time like Marx and Hegel began propagating the view that religion was hugely detrimental to human progress. While Marx dismissed religion as the opium of the masses, Hegel argued that religion was detrimental to social progress since it was based on faith rather than reason. Hegel said what society needed was reason because it was superior to faith. This then led to communism, a political philosophy wherein humans prospered not by profiteering, but by sharing and caring. Later, communism became the official doctrine of the Bolshevik Republic, born of the revolution in Russia, which in 1917 threw out the Tsarist monarchy. And from this grew later the USSR, which extended all the way from Eastern Europe to the Pacific. Through hard collective effort, the USSR transformed the poor agrarian society of Tsarist times into an industrial giant of sorts and also a significant military power. Politically, the USSR was very rigid, although it tried to proclaim itself as a people-friendly country with the catchy phrase, dictatorship of the masses. In practice, it denied space for creative people, since they were seen as potential enemies of the state. Scientists fared a bit better as long as they did not conflict with the state, and scientists took care of it by not becoming deeply immersed in politics. They devoted a lot of time to science, and this way they kept out of trouble. Political trouble, that is. However, this did not mean that they had plenty of freedom. That was limited in the sense they could not easily travel abroad unless they were also hardcore members of the Communist Party. Now, I must also make a mention of the in-between system, namely socialism, where there is a constitutional democracy with limited capitalism and extensive public ownership of manufacture and trading as two bookends. Clement Attlee introduced socialism in the UK following World War II, which Mrs. Thatcher later dismantled with great pleasure, I might add. When India became independent in 1947, it formally declared itself to be a sovereign, secular and socialist democratic republic. Since 1990, however, India has increasingly moved towards the free market ideology. It is of interest to note that on July 24, 1959, there was a famous and almost unintended debate between Nikita Khrushchev, General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, and Richard Nixon, Vice President of the US. The occasion was the opening in Moscow of an exhibition of US achievements. Nixon was supposed to inaugurate the exhibition, while Khrushchev was the chief guest. Now, as these two people were moving around the exhibition, it so happened that as the two VIPs entered a stall exhibiting a typical American kitchen, they got into a debate. This was accidental. The Americans, of course, were far ahead of the Soviets when it came to standard of living, and the typical American kitchen exhibited there simply blew away the ordinary Russian visitor to the exhibition. Richard Nixon seized the opportunity and proudly asked Khrushchev whether Russia had anything like this. Khrushchev was obviously embarrassed, but he tried to save the day by asserting that in the long haul, communism would triumph because it was people-friendly, while capitalism, based as it was on greed, would fail miserably and collapse. As we all know, history has given a different verdict, with most of the countries in the world now having adopted some version or the other of capitalism, and there are only barely a handful of countries like China and Cuba left which proclaim themselves to be communists. Even China has modified its brand of communism by liberalizing manufacture, trade and commerce while adhering to full state control where politics is concerned. Now, I am mentioning all this because Gurcharan Das makes many references to various political ideologies, asserting finally that there is really no alternative to market capitalism. And yet, Das is somewhat unhappy because of the way capitalism is currently functioning, especially its vulnerability to moral failures. Das says, there is a fine line between rational self-interest and selfishness, reminding us of the historical origin of the subject of economics. I think I should at this point turn to the Nobel Prize winning economist Amartya Sen, who has comprehensively covered the topic of ethics and economics in his Berkeley lectures, published now as a book by the Oxford University Press with the title On Ethics and Economics. Sen says, and I quote, "Economics has had two rather different origins, both related to politics, but related in rather different ways, concerned respectively with ethics on the one hand and with what may be called engineering on the other. End of quote. Now, although economics as a formal subject is of relatively recent origin, more about this shortly, in a sense, its origins go far back in time. Where the Western world is concerned, it all began when Socrates asked the ethical question, how should one live? Obviously, Socrates was seeking a codification of how an individual should live ethically. Aristotle, who came later, essentially said that one should live in such a manner that is good for him, meaning that his life must be so lived so as to benefit that person. However, Aristotle also added, and here I am quoting from Sen, though it is worthwhile to attain the end for one man, it is finer and more godlike to attain it for a nation or for city-states. I hope you understand what Sen is trying to say. Basically, he said, you must work not only for yourself, but all your fellow beings. Now, as opposed to the ethical approach to economics, there is also the engineering approach which emerged in the 19th century. Basically, it's a systems approach where the market is regarded as a system functioning in a society with various interconnections and interrelationships. Such a model of socioeconomics provided the opportunity for a logical and even mathematical analysis of how the system would work, as also computer simulation studies. In this approach, economics automatically gets connected to politics as well as to statecraft. Having said all that, Sen points out that it was in India that the first book on economics was written. I'm sure you're surprised by that. Well, that book carries the name Arthashastra, and it was written in the 4th century BC by Kautilya, an advisor and a minister to the Emperor Chandragupta Maurya, founder of the Maurya dynasty. And incidentally, Chandragupta Maurya was the grandfather of the famous Ashoka. About Kautilya's Arthashastra, which may be loosely translated as the philosophy of wealth, Sen has the following to say, quote, the treatise begins in the first chapter with the distinction between four fields of knowledge, including one, metaphysics, two, knowledge of right and wrong. But then it settles down to discussing more practical types of knowledge dealing with three, the science of government, and four, the science of wealth. It is interesting, notes Sen, Amartya Sen that is, that Kautilya is concerned with practical aspects of governance like building of villages, land classification, collection of revenue, tariff regulations, and even topics such as employing spies, controlling embezzlement of state funds by officers, and so on. But there is little about the moral issues raised by Socrates and Aristotle, who, by the way, was a contemporary of Kautilya, but living in a different continent. It is not that Kautilya was unaware of Dharma. In fact, his explicit reference to the knowledge of right and wrong makes clear that he knew about Dharma and its issues. Perhaps Kautilya assumed that people of those days were expected to be dharmic in their actions, and therefore it is that he concentrated mainly on details of statecraft. At the working level, Sen describes Kautilya's work as belonging to the engineering approach to economics. Going back to the historical origins of the subject of modern economics in the Western world, Sen inevitably refers to Adam Smith, often hailed as the father of modern economics. I'm sure you must have heard this name many times. And for your information, Adam Smith was a professor of moral philosophy at the University of Glasgow. And back then, economics was considered as a mere branch of ethics. Indeed, until much later, the subject of economics used to be taught in Cambridge University as a part of moral science tripos, just as physics used to be a part of natural philosophy. That is sufficient to highlight the importance attached back then to the role of morals in practical economics. Maybe I should offer here a quote due to Adam Smith that needs to be examined in the light of what Socrates than Aristotle said about 1500 years earlier. Smith wrote, quote, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our necessities, but of their advantages." End of quote. Basically, Smith is saying the obvious. People work, produce goods, and sell them and so on, in order that they can earn money and put some food on the table. Of course, they use some of that money for purchasing various things they need, a process that helps producer of those particular goods to put food on their tables. If you think of it, production soon becomes a diverging cycle. I mean, take a farmer. To do his work, the farmer needs a plow. That means someone else has to make plows and sell them to farmers. Now, the maker of the plow has to get steel from somewhere who makes steel. And so on, there develops a diverging circle of production. In other words, production and trade do have their positive aspects. Keeping this in mind, let us go back to Adam Smith, who, in the very first page of his book, The Theory of Moral Sentiment, says the following, and I quote, "How selfish soever man may be supposed, there are evidently some principles in his nature which interest him in the fortune of others and render their happiness necessary to him, though he derives nothing from it except the pleasure of seeing it." What Smith is saying is that people who produce goods for others love it when their customers are happy. Problems arise only when dishonesty enters the picture and goods that are produced and services that are offered become detrimental to society, like the manufacture of cigarettes and drugs. These days, there has been a sharp increase in such dubious and unethical activities that are unquestionably against the broader interests of society. Basically, in Smith's view, man is not entirely a selfish animal. Smith was conscious of the fact that man does work in his self-interest, no doubt. However, that does not mean he is totally devoid of concern for others' welfare and happiness. Sadly, things have changed drastically since then due to two major reasons. Firstly, individuals have become considerably more self-centered, which means they have become disconnected with society and its larger interests. Secondly, basic human values have been totally squeezed out of economic principles that govern society at the present time. The feeling seems to be that economics is all about generating wealth, growth, beating the competition, etc., and has no connection with morals and values, which are the concern of people connected to religion and theology. As Sun puts it, and I quote, "Modern economics has substantially impoverished itself by the distance that has grown between economics and ethics." But I would like to argue that economics, as it has emerged, can be made more productive by paying greater and more explicit attention to the ethical considerations that shape human behavior and judgment. In brief, Sen wants the dry, soulless, market-forced economic philosophy of modern times to be tempered with a strong dose of ethics. It is interesting at this stage to digress briefly to draw attention to the way physics has drifted away from moral philosophy after the Renaissance. Now, philosophy in ancient Europe had three strands, namely the strand of moral philosophy, the strand of religious philosophy, and the strand of natural philosophy. They were all intertwined. In the 17th century, Newton broke away from this tradition by discussing mechanics without any reference to God. Now, it's not that Newton had become an atheist. Far from it. On the contrary, Newton was, as they say, a God-fearing man. In fact, at one time he even wanted to enter the church. If that was the case, why on earth did Newton not bring God in his great work? He did not do that because Newton considered dynamics to be a practical matter involving the motion of particles under an external force. Yes, God was the presiding deity of everything that exists, But that does not mean that you have to talk about God all the time in everything that you do, especially when dealing with down-to-earth practical matters. And that is how natural philosophy became disconnected with the feeling or the emotional part of moral philosophy, otherwise referred to as the spiritual part. I think I owe here an explanation for making extended references to economics. Actually, Sen, who by the way is a non-believer, has given the answer. As he points out, historically economics was born out of an examination of how one should behave, etc. Later, however, the engineering aspect took over, and presently it has almost edged out the original ethical overtones of economics. So we have sort of kicked out ethics and morality from everywhere. I must also draw attention to the fact that Adam Smith used the term self-interest in his analysis, leading subsequently to much discussion about the subtle difference between self-interest and selfishness. I find it amusing because in spirituality, we don't do this hair splitting. From Swami's point of view, selfishness, that is swartham as Swami used to refer to it, and self-interest or suprajanam as he used to refer to it, are both in the same bracket and not in two different ones, as many economists seem to suggest. Swami has made it quite clear that both self-interest and selfishness are nothing but two aspects of dehabhimanam or body consciousness, which stimulates ahamkaram or ego. In other words, whether you talk of selfishness or self-interest, they are all aspects of ego. And while in a worldly sense ego might appear to lead to good consequences, in the larger picture those so-called good consequences are always harmful to society as a whole. For example, it could be argued that the cigarette industry generates millions of jobs and brings in a lot of revenue to the state via taxes. Really? Should the state earn money by slowly killing millions? Is that a good thing to do? Is it moral? So there are many questions we need to ask. So, let me at this juncture offer some remarks on how people these days think about ethics and morality. We all use these words. Do you know what exactly they mean? Here is some indication of how these words are understood at present. Ethics refers to a code of conduct adopted by society as a whole. In other words, ethics is defined for the individual by others, i.e. society. Now, we all know that social behavior invariably changes with the passage of time. That should mean that ethics also is flexible and subject to change with time and circumstances. Morals, on the other hand, are supposed to be individual-centric and relate to do's and don'ts and right and wrong that the individual has to be careful about. Morality is that thus a personal moral compass of right and wrong. Can morality change with time? In my view, no, but since morality as understood at present depends on personal attitudes and behavior, it too is prone to change with time. Now, some of you may feel confused and say, tell me, give me an example of ethics changing with time. Well, the simplest way I can do it is to draw your attention to movies. Now, India has produced movies since the late 20s, if I am not mistaken, certainly the early 30s, the 20th century. Movies back then were very conservative, and the mixing of the genders had to follow the strict code followed by society. In other words, you couldn't have sort of free mixing between men and women as we see in today's movies. What does that mean? The censors have become very liberal. Back in those days, all such scenes were cut out, scissored, removed. And it is the censored version of the movie that was released for public viewing. Today, censors have become almost irrelevant, and most of the time, movie producers get away with what they want in the name of change of ethics. Well, I brought in ethics and morals because they are not of such great importance to us as dharma is. In fact, in a true dharmic system, ethics and morality must be part of dharma. What is this dharma? It is something that is spiritual in origin, and it is a code, a guiding principle that has been laid down by spirituality. This guiding principle is universal and unchanging, and it is this guiding principle that helps us to decide between right and wrong. This universal guiding principle applies to every single individual at all times, in all circumstances, and while engaging in any kind of action, be it via thought, word or deed. And it is this guiding principle that Swami often referred to as Atma Dharma. That being said, at the individual level, different people face different situations and circumstances. Hence, judgments about right and wrong must be determined on a case-by-case basis, within, however, the ambit of Atma Dharma. It is that this case-by-case detailing of how actions must actually be performed that is referred to as Paradharma. Manu was among the first to offer a working manual of this kind, and Manu Dharma is comparable to the commandments of Moses. Later, we would become intensely engaged in a discussion of Atma Dharma and Paradharma, but for now, maybe as an exercise, we can ask whether what Yudhishthira did by wagering his wife was right or wrong, using the above considerations. I leave this as an exercise for you to analyze the situation and come to your own conclusion, but this much I am sure you would agree with, and that is that being linked to the eternal, dharma is unchanging, and dharma is the same for all. Now, do you think this is what Das believes? From what I have read of his book, I don't think so. Rather, his dharma appears to be some kind of a hybrid of ethics and morality as described earlier, with a fuzzy internal consistency between the two. I am sure you appreciate the fact that ethics and morality must be consistent because the individual is a part of society. Now, a distinctive and important characteristic of dharma according to Das is that it has to be God-free. In my view, that would make dharma into a rudderless boat drifting in a vast ocean with strong winds blowing. Having said that, I must also stress that Das is very compassionate, and that is something very commendable. He believes very strongly in compassion. Many people do. In fact, presently in the West, a lot of people accept compassion even while rejecting God. And that is one of the reasons why the Dalai Lama commands a lot of attention in the West, because Buddhism is all about compassion, love and non-violence, but does not make any explicit mention about God. And what does Swami say? Well, you can have Satya, Dharma, Santi, Prema, Ahimsa, Karuna, Kshama, etc. But please remember that it is God who is Satya, God who is Dharma, God who is Shanti, God who is Prema, God who is Ahimsa, God who is Daya, God who is Karuna, Kshama and on. That is why we call him Dayanidhi, Kripanidhi, Karunanidhi, etc. Few in India appreciate that compassion is a key element of Vedanta, even as it is of Buddhism. And it's also pertinent to remember that Vedanta came before Buddhism. In a sense, Buddhism is a derivative of Vedanta, except with some changes. And turning to science, my own experience is that even today, many of the older scientists in India, like those in my age group, are comfortable with the Upanishads, having been exposed to it in their earlier years. Perhaps it is also because the self of Vedanta reminds them of the vacuum of quantum field theory. That said, all these scientists are rather reluctant to accept all this in public. Possibly that is so because currently it is fashionable to be dismissive of spirituality. And so they try to be politically correct. And when it comes to avatar, it's no surprise that almost all our scientists are openly skeptical. And as I said, that's the politically correct thing to do. I'm not belonging to that camp, let me assure you. I'm sure many of you might find this particular talk strongly focused on topics political. And that is because the Das himself offers plenty of comments on various political systems, besides discussing the merit of the free market. That being said, it must also be noted that political systems do not feature in the rest of Das' book, except when he is about to wind the book up. There on page 289, Das says, and I quote, "Competition is an economic stimulant that promotes human welfare," as my father used to say. "The choice is not between the free market and central planning, but in getting the right mix of regulation. No one wants state ownership of production where the absence of competition corrodes the character even more. The answer is not to seek moral perfection, which inevitably leads to theocracy and dictatorship. Since it is in man's nature to own more, one learns to live with human imperfection and one seeks regulation that not only tames Duryodhanas, but also rewards dharmalic behavior in the market." End of quote. This highlights how sensitive people yearn for a society where not only are individuals honest and have integrity, but society as a whole also is law-abiding and concerned about securing both welfare and fairness for all. Das also has such a yearning, but leaves us with a question, which is, how does one achieve that regulation? More specifically, how are the Duryodhanas of the world to be tamed? Das is clear that dharma ought to be the tool, and indeed, the book is all about his search for dharma. But does he find the right formula? Here is what Das says towards the end of his book. "My own search for dharma has led me to the conclusion that morality is natural to the way human beings have evolved as social, intelligent and enduring animals. One can be skeptical about the existence of God, but one can still believe in being good and live a deeply moral life." While expressing this view, Das says the philosopher David Hume, who writes, and I quote, "There is no such passion in human minds as the love of mankind, independent of personal qualities, of services, or of relation to ourselves." End of quote. Frankly, I don't understand what Hume exactly means, especially because I do not have access to Hume's book. Even if I did, I doubt if I would have the time to go through it. To me, it seems that Hume is saying that people may have a larger concern for humanity, humanness, etc., no matter what their personal lives are. If that is what Hume is trying to tell us, then I am ready to accept that. Indeed, this is true of many people presently. Now, here I must draw attention to the importance of personal values. And this I do by drawing attention to the American politician Barry Goldwater, now no more. Barry Goldwater was a Republican and an arch-conservative who was so far to the right that he did not bat an eyelid about waging nuclear war. In 1964, he contested for the presidency as a Republican candidate. He was standing against Lyndon Johnson. And one of Goldwater's slogans was, "Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice." I repeat, extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. Goldwater meant, of course, the liberty of Americans. Wanting the people of one's country to enjoy liberty cannot be objected to. However, extremism to secure this liberty? Really? Going back to the issue of individual behavior and public welfare, there are many who are deeply passionate about the preservation of wilderness, wildlife, whales, wild animals like the tiger, the rhino, elephants, and so on. This is very commendable. In personal life, however, they may have many moral shortcomings. But at the societal level, their views are certainly noble. Perhaps we see here the two aspects of the individual, namely the selfish personal aspect and the impersonal aspect that Goethe talked about. I hope you recall this from one of my earlier talks. Possibly it is aspects of such wider concern that Das has in mind while referring to believing in being good and live a deeply moral life. But that is a kind of compartmentalized morality that people are presently prepared to accept at the best. Spirituality, on the other hand, does not allow room for such compartmentalized existence. Rather, it demands one uniform code of values that apply both at the macro as well as the micro level. Stated differently, today's ethics and morality would become fused into a consistent working framework under the larger umbrella of the Atmadharma. Swami has described the Atmadharma as the essence of the Gita. And Dharma, as described by the Gita, does provide an answer to the Socratic question, how should one behave, how should one live, and also answers Aristotelian questions. In fact, Paradharma is all about that. So, the long and short of it is that Dharma boils down to a moral compass that one must use in life in order to make life itself a journey to God. Having said that, it is also true, as Krishna himself has pointed out in Shloka 7:16, that devotees fall into four categories, broad categories, they being the one in distress, namely Arti, the one seeking wealth, Artati, the one who is desirous of knowledge, Jignasu, and the enlightened one, or Jnani. Empirically, it is known that almost 99.99% of devotees fall into the first two categories. That was way back in the Dwapara Yuga. Krishna himself has confirmed this by saying, among thousands of men, scarcely one strives for perfection, and among those who so strive, hardly one truly knows me. Sloka 7.3. That was back then. You can make your own guess as to how much the percentage of jignasus and jnanis must have shrunk since then. I'm sure many of you are shaking your heads and perhaps telling yourself, well, Guru Charan Das is after all right. Let us be practical. Perfection is not for us. Maybe we should move on and let the retired guys waste their time by talking about Dharma. Here, I would like all who have come into physical contact with Swami to pause for a moment and think hard. Krishna gave his message just once, using Arjuna as his instrument. And Swami has told us many times that Krishna's main purpose in incarnating was to give that message. Just to give one message, Krishna came down to earth. Swami too came for this very same purpose. But this being Kali Yuga, Swami has given that message over 1,000 times. Have you ever thought about that? In fact, we here in our studios have at least 850 or so discourse tapes, some of them going as far back as the mid-60s of last century. And so, what we are seeing is that Swami has unpacked the 700 slokas of the Gita and repackaged them into several hundreds of discourses, certainly more than the 850 we have. And while doing this, he addressed the message to specific audiences like Vedic pandits, students, teachers, women, villagers, businessmen, professionals, doctors, army people, and so on. And why on earth did Swami may take so much trouble when the road to God is so forbidding? Because there is hope for all of us. We can fulfill the goal of life. It is not as difficult as one thinks. All one has to do is take a clear and firm step every time. One small step every time, and keep on doing it throughout life. We are sure to reach the goal. This is something elementary, but we fail to understand it. And that is why Swami came for us and relentlessly spoke to us in great detail. Now, there are a lot of details about going on the road towards God, and that I shall put off for a later time. I'm putting off so many things like this, but be assured I will come to them when the time is right. For now, I'd like to say that considering the way the planetary ecosystem is being ravaged in the name of growth, the time has come to put an end to this suicidal madness and start paying attention to Swami's advice. And how do we do this? By first beginning to place a ceiling on desires. Desires, that is where most troubles start. Long ago, Lord Krishna said, and he said this in Shloka 3.19, desire is the wise man's eternal foe, O Kaunteya, and is like an insatiable fire. If desire is the enemy, objects and entities that arouse desire are the foe's most powerful tools. The only way to overcome the deadly enemy would be to say no thanks whenever temptations are dangled before us. Now look at this. The mind is so powerful that it can do amazing things. It is due to the power of the mind that man has been able to land Curiosity rover on Mars. And it is due to man's power that humanity has been able to send an object well out of the solar system and it's now wandering across the galaxy Milky Way. But the mind is able to do such fantastic things. Why then does the mind become so meek and feeble as to yield to even silly offers made by a cunning enemy named desire? Where does the power of the mind suddenly evaporate and disappear when it is needed most? These are questions we have to ask ourselves. Now, Das says we need some regulation so that market does not go wild. I would remind the good author that it is human desire that starts all the trouble. Hence, that regulation must come from within each and every one of us. No use having outside regulation. That won't work. Man will always cheat. On the other hand, what we really need is regulation imposed from within. That regulation must start in the heart and end in the mind. That is why Swami often talked about control of the senses and mind, and the mind and sense control. That would be the first step in the journey towards God. Life, Swami has told us again and again, has been given for that purpose. I have to live in such a manner that we slowly move closer and closer to God. In the ultimate analysis, that is where Dharma enters the picture. Dharma is the road and Dharma is the destination. To search for Dharma, forgetting this basic concept, would, in my opinion, be a purposeless exercise. Time is moving on and I must wind up. But before doing so, I'd like to examine whether there is any economic model other than those already tried so far, including market-based economy, that will not spell doom for us. Now, nature tells us there is. And in that model, humanity would have to turn to planetary sustainability as its guiding principle instead of endless competition and endless growth. Delivering the famous BBC Rate Lectures, Lord Martin Rees of UK observed, he's a great astronomer who discovered the quasars, by the way. Lord Martin Rees observed that at the current growth rate, we would need about 4 planet Earths to provide the raw materials for 7.2 billion people living now on Earth, so that they may all enjoy the American standard of living. Is that possible? No, it's a pipe dream. And I refer you to a book titled Consumptionomics by Chandran Nair. He explains why this is not possible. And doesn't take rocket science to understand what Nair is explaining. On the other hand, said Lord Rees, this planet can sustain a population of 15 billion if all of us agree to lower a standard of living to that of an average person in Costa Rica. How many are prepared to do it? Anyway, there it is. By the way, actually Gandhiji brought this to our attention a long time ago. But that is another topic that I have to put away for later discussion. Well, dear listeners, that is all I have to say for now. I hope you would stay with this series and keep sending those questions of yours. By the way, when the transcript of this talk appears on our website, kindly follow 3 links that will be given there. All of them lead to talks given by Gurchand Das on his book during his book tour, both here and in America. Offering this talk to Swami, I now sign off. God bless and Jai Sai Ram. Thank you.
Sai Ram, dear listeners, that brings to an end talk number 5 in the current series on Dharma presented by Professor G. Venkatraman. Dear listener, your questions and feedback are valuable to us. You may write to listener@radiosai.org, and if you don't mind, kindly draw the attention of people who have missed this program to listen to it by downloading the podcast, which is available on our website www.radiosai.org. Coming up next on Thursday Live is the segment Service, Love in Action. Thank you and Sai Ram.